KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. This month, the Finance Committee will meet Monday, July 24th at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the screening of Promised Land, July 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the Rivergate Church in Portland. Promised Land is a social justice documentary that follows two tribes in the Pacific Northwest, the Duwamish and the Chinook, as they fight for restoration of treaty rights that have long since been denied. The film examines the way that government and society still look at tribal sovereignty. Again, that's a screening of the documentary film Promised Land, July 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the Rivergate Church, 7634 Southwest Capitol Highway in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, it's 9 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on KABU, first, it's Veterans Voice Radio, talking today with Army veteran Hamilton Gregory, author of McNamara's Folly, The Use of Low IQ Troops in the Vietnam War. At 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and then at 11, Between the Lines Radio examines the Presidential Commission on Election Integrity and calls it a GOP Trojan horse to expand voter suppression. At 11:30, Making Contact explores the aftermath of the Ghost Ship fire and the battle to preserve live workspaces. And we thank you, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one when you go to kabu.fm and click on Donate. And we'll have a little musical introduction, and stay tuned for Veterans Voice.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are a-changing. Writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. 'Cause the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times they are a-changing. The mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. Oh, the times they are a-changing. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be passed. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River, and 104.3 FM Corvallis in Albany. And you can hear KBOO on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. And if you feel like it, you can hear some of our old shows by going to kboo.fm/veteransvoice. And also, Angie does great on Facebook. You can see some of the articles that Angie puts up. You go to Veteran Voice Radio Show on Facebook, and Angie's got some good articles. I'm Marvin, and I'm here with my pal, Angie.
Good morning.
And we got an announcement to make here first, and then we're going to talk with Hamilton Gregory about his book, McNamara's Folly, The Use of Low IQ Troops in the Vietnam War. We've talked to Hamilton before, but I wanted to do it again, and I'll tell you why in just a little bit. But Angie's got an announcement she wants to do.
Yeah, there is a bill that is going to be going to the Senate, and that is to force Congress and the Department of Defense to recognize veterans who were exposed to sarin gas back in 1962. Right now, there are no protections for some of the things that are happening to these veterans, and there were approximately 5,900 of these veterans who were exposed to gas, and it was under a project called Project 112. And they've experienced convulsions, paralysis, respiratory failure, and even death. And for a long time, they were just saying that didn't even happen. That's what the Pentagon said. And so now they've had to actually acknowledge that happened. And it wasn't just the nerve gas, but also E. coli and all these other testing agents. They experimented on service members and even some civil servants. So the bill is introduced by Representative Mike Thompson, Democrat from California. And that's just one of the things that that I came across that I thought was pretty amazing, that they're not even acknowledging that they're feeling sick from these things. And I posted the article on the Facebook page,
right.
And it's on Military Times, and that's where I found it. It's called Commentary, House Defense Bill Fails Veterans Exposed to Toxins in U.S.-Run Tests. And that just came out yesterday.
Wow.
that article.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, because there's a lot of that happens that never gets talked about, you know.
Well, I sure wonder about all those anthrax shots I got.
That's what I was just going to bring up.
I got six of them.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
And here's the thing about that is, when for one, we got them all when we were in the Gulf. The only way to get away was to jump over the side of the boat.
Yeah.
And we had to sign waivers saying that we would accept the shot, and if we didn't, then we would get a dishonorable discharge and lose all of our benefits.
Wow. Yeah, because I remember when that was going on that we had a real problem with that, and we did shows on that because that was made us so angry that they were forcing folks to take those shots. And those shots were never cleared by the FDA or whoever.
Right, yeah.
Those shots were never cleared. And mm-hmm. they were forcing the troops to take those shots.
Well, what's strange about years later, I got these studies in the mail saying asking me all kinds of weird medical questions, and some of them were really bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you sweat when it's cold? And I actually do. I actually only sweat when it's cold. When it's cold,
wow.
I sweat like it's 95 degrees outside.
Wow.
And that never happened to me before, and I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but it's just a weird circumstance that question would be on there.
So, how many questions did they have? Do you remember?
I've gotten a few of those questionnaires in the mail, and they would ask maybe 150 to 100 questions, and then you'd mail it back.
Wow.
And I would do it because why not?
Yeah, do it.
But I thought that it was pretty telling that we couldn't do anything. The only no that we could say would be no, and I also basically am quitting the military right now,
right,
with nothing. So, and that the other option was that or to jump.
Yeah, that's because we after the first Gulf War, you know, there was a lot of folks coming back, you know, with Gulf War syndrome, you know, and we did a testing for it was a congressman from the Midwest contacted us, and we did a testing for them, saliva test and a urine test, and we sent it down to a place in California, and it came back, you know, these guys really got hit hard with something, and we sent these questionnaires back about what you're talking about, you know, and not only did we told the congressman that we wouldn't do it unless we could test the families, because we were getting reports that family members were having some of these same symptoms.
Hmm.
And there was a lot of women who would become pregnant and lose the babies, you know, real fast. And I would say probably 80% of all the forms that we got back, there at least once in every family.
Hmm.
And it was just devastating what happened to these people.
One of these days we're going to have to do a show on depleted uranium.
And, oh, yeah, and for sure.
You know who a good contact would be? I believe Colonel Ann Wright.
Ann Wright, right.
Does a lot of research on that. And so depleted uranium is one of those toxic neurotoxins that has affected not only people in Iraq, but also military members as well, and that is a substance that can, it's an endocrine inhibitor,
right?
And it actually can change the DNA in your body, so it can affect your offspring.
Yep, that's
so,
a big problem.
So sometimes you don't even know you're affected until you try to have a
children.
Child,
right?
So that would be
that's a good one.
A topic for a future show.
You know, some of the folks that got hit really hard with depleted uranium shells were tankers, guys in tanks, because they would fire those rounds and get that blowback, and it'd get into their lungs and everything. And those guys came back really sick, really, really sick. And that was a real problem. And, that's a good one. And, you know, Bill Byers, who was on this show for, 20 years or so, he was an atomic vet. And we did some shows about that down in the Nevada test site and also in the Pacific on the illnesses those guys got. And then Agent Orange, which we got, and what you folks got. You know, it's this continuous cycle of the military just destroying its people. And that's something I'm going to talk about here in just a minute. We're going to talk to Hamilton in just a second. But I have it at my house. I have a huge library, probably 300, 350 books on the Vietnam War. And I have about 20-some books on that were written by North Vietnamese soldiers about their experience in the war. And but I go back and read certain books over and, you know, over and over and over, and one of them is Waiting for an Army to Die by Fred Wilcox about Agent Orange in Vietnam. And it also mentions the atomic veterans in that too. And I go back and I reread that book, and it's very, 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 very telling, especially with Agent Orange, with us guys, is that that toxin that they sprayed over there, they sprayed all over, and they say they were doing it to get rid of the jungle so that the enemy couldn't hide, but we couldn't hide either, you know, and it sprayed on their food and their water, and it sprayed on us, and, you know, we have some horrible diseases. And just like the Vietnamese, they have these horrible diseases. And the problem with the Agent Orange, that dioxin, it goes into your fatty tissues. And as you get older, you lose weight, and that comes out. And our bodies aren't as strong now to fight that off. So as we get older, we get more and more of those diseases from the Agent Orange exposure. And it's pretty devastating to us. And the second book that I read all the time, I go back and read, is Working Class War by Christian Appy. And it's a pretty good book. It's pretty thick, but it's a really good book. And it talks about how the military came through and took all the poor kids and poor working class kids, and what percentage of them, you know. It's just an amazing book. If anybody wants to read those two books, it's Waiting for an Army to Die by Fred Wilcox. It's really great. And the other one is Working Class War by Christian Appy, who we interviewed here one time, Christian, when he was in town. And that's really a good book. And the next and newest book that I got that I go back and I've read a few times is McNamara's Folly, the Use of Low IQ Troops in the Vietnam War, because I think it's very telling about, you know, what happened, and we're going to talk to Hamilton about that. And I remember my dad, who fought in World War II, talking about some of those guys, you know, that some of those guys shouldn't have been in the military either. And my dad talked about some of those guys. So it's been going on for quite a while. And even in these wars that they've got going on now, when they weren't able to get enough recruits, the guys weren't passing the physicals or the mental. Remember, they lowered the score on the ASVAB test, and they were accepting guys who had misdemeanors.
Well, when I was at MEPS, there was a guy with a felony there.
A felony, yep. They just lowered everything, you know. And Vietnam, I knew some of these guys that had tried to enlist in the military. They wanted to be in the military, but they couldn't pass the dang test. You know, they got really low scores, and they couldn't get in. And then when they came out with
criminal history that would normally prevent them from joining, and now they're able to.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden they did this thing here, and these guys were getting it in. You know. In the service and being put in combat arms, you know, infantry, artillery, armor, you know, and they shouldn't have been there. And we're going to talk to Hamilton about that. Hamilton, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing fine. Delighted to be with you and Angie.
Oh, it's great.
Thank you.
It was great when I talked to you. Like I was saying, you know, I go back and I read those books, and your book is on that list now that I think is really, really important to read. And I wish more people would read it. How did you, you know, we talked about this before, but how did you get interested in this subject?
When I was in basic training at Fort Benning in 1967, I knew some of these men. As a matter of fact, when I was in the induction center in Nashville, Tennessee in the summer of 1967, I was assigned to accompany one of these men to Fort Benning. And the sergeant, he used the term McNamara's moron, so I'd never heard the term. Mm-hmm. And I learned later, of course, what it meant. But the sergeant said, I want you to go with this man to Fort Benning. Don't let him out of your sight. Go with him every step of the way. He can't read or write.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to Fort Benning, you're going to have to help him fill out paperwork. That was my first introduction to one of these low IQ men who were drafted. And it was a very cynical program that McNamara and Lyndon Johnson cooked up. It was called Project 100,000 because they planned to take 100,000 of these low aptitude men each year, but the program was much larger. Some people think, oh, it was just 100,000 total. No, it was a total of 354,000 of these men.
Oof.
And they were mostly in the Army, but they were also in the Marine Corps and the Air Force and the Navy. And their death rate in combat was three times higher than the death rate for the average GI.
Mm.
The total of these men who were killed, 5,478.
Wow.
It was a terrible tragedy that Johnson and McNamara inflicted. And since my book came out, I've gotten letters from all over the country from veterans who tell about the men that they knew. Like one veteran wrote and said, how could a guy be in a firefight and not understand that standing to urinate will get your head blown off?
Yeah.
I'm getting all kinds of, and of course I did a lot of research for the book, but getting a lot of feedback from all over the country.
Let me ask you a question. Why, you know, at that time, they were, like, I got drafted in 67, and at that time, even before that, Hamilton, they were needing more and more and more and more guys, and they wouldn't go after the college kids.
Right. Yeah, there's some secret tapes that came out after the war. McNamara and Johnson sitting in the Oval Office cooking this thing up. Johnson referred to these men as, quote, second-class fellows.
Mm.
That's what he called them, second-class fellows. And they talked about how they were desperate for manpower, but they didn't want to draft college boys because the middle-class voters would be angry. And you don't want to anger voters. And they didn't want to take National Guardsmen and reservists because that, too, would anger the middle class. At that time, of course, it was much different in the era of Middle Eastern wars. But
right.
At that time, National Guard and reserves were not sent to Vietnam for the most part. There were just very few of them. And you probably recall, Marvin, how so many men tried to get into the National Guard or reserves.
Yes.
To avoid combat.
Hello? Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, because we kind of lost you for a minute there. Yeah, a lot of guys got out of there was a big, long list of guys waiting to get into the National Guard or into the reserves at that time.
Yeah,
and the college kids, of course, got those deferments, and they wouldn't have to go. At that, I don't know if you was part of you when you were writing this book, as General Hershey, remember, was in charge of the draft.
Yeah,
Selective Service, and he said that he's not going to take these boys that are in college. You know, we're not going to take those boys. They're going to, you know, get degrees, and they're going to, you know, help the country. They're going to do all this. And
yeah.
So we're going to get the other boys. It's what he said.
I didn't come across that quotation.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, he said that.
That was the attitude in the Johnson administration.
Exactly. So, I want to ask you some more about this. Talk about some of the things that these guys did, some of our brother Vietnam veterans, these guys, what jobs they did in Vietnam, what their jobs were, and what people said about them.
Well, most of the men in Project 100,000, most of them went to Vietnam, and a large portion of them were sent into combat units.
Mm-hmm.
And they had trouble because they were slow in their thinking and had mental limitations. And some of the officers and sergeants in Vietnam tried to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
They would give them non-dangerous jobs away from combat. But a number of them went into combat, and as I say, their fatality rate was three times that of other GIs, but they were disproportionately placed in combat units.
Yeah, I talked to you about this before. We had a few of these guys in our unit, in our company, and the platoon leader, he did that too. He tried to get these guys, you know, out of the field, basically, because you couldn't trust them, Hamilton.
Yeah.
You couldn't trust these guys. I mean, it wasn't their fault, but
right.
You couldn't trust them. They would forget things. You know, they would forget when we were, you know, standing down and we had to get TO&E'd up, you know, our ammunition, our food, our, you know, clothing, all this stuff. They would forget. They would forget
yeah.
stuff. They would, like you were talking, they would stand up in a fight. They would stand
yeah.
up. Or they couldn't read maps. They
yeah.
couldn't use the radio. Because I remember one of our platoon leaders thought, we'll let this guy carry the radio. But he couldn't remember the call signs.
Yeah.
He couldn't remember the frequencies and stuff. And
yeah,
so that
I
was
tell,
a real problem.
Yeah, I tell the story, the true story of a man just like that who
mm-hmm.
who was very limited mentally, and he was assigned to be the radio man, and
mm-hmm.
he was described as being a hard worker, a man of high character, but he couldn't he just couldn't operate the radio. And
yep.
He was kept in the unit while the platoon leader tried to get a real radio man, somebody who could really operate it.
Right.
And this poor guy, while he was still with the unit, he was shot and severely wounded, and he died a week later.
Oh, boy.
And
That's sad.
I'd like to ask something. I'm sure that probably the government couldn't have just said, okay, we're going to take these guys and then they're going to go into war into Vietnam. They must have had some other method to convince people that this was a good idea.
Yeah, good
how,
question.
How did they actually form the public's opinion to
yeah.
be accepting?
Well, there are several things. One is that most of these men were in the lower economic levels of society, so they didn't have parents who could write letters or object. They didn't have the skills that a lot of middle-class men had of saying, "No, wait a minute, you know, I should not be going into this." But you raise a good point about, in effect, how could McNamara get away with this? McNamara was a believer in technology, and he said he argued in his speeches and his presentations to Congress. He argued that these men, their IQ levels, their intelligence levels would be raised because he said the Army is the world's greatest educator of skilled manpower. Which is true. And he said, we are going to raise their intelligence level by using videotapes.
Hmm. Wow.
He was very naive. One of his biographers said that McNamara was a naive believer in technological miracles. And so he thought these men would, that he could raise their level, and of course, of intelligence, but of course, educators and psychologists said, well, this is nonsense. Well, yes, video is a wonderful tool. It can help students to learn. But McNamara said, and this is almost a direct quote, he said, a low aptitude student can use videotapes as part of his formal instruction, and he can end up by becoming as proficient as a high aptitude student. Ooh. And that's just nonsense.
That's
do you think that
nonsense.
They actually believe that, or do you think that that's what they were just telling people?
Well, a lot of people think that McNamara was totally cynical. I've given the benefit of the doubt. I think he was, because he was naive on so many other things.
Oh, yeah. Hmm.
I think he probably really believed that. Well, did videotapes help? Well, we'll never know, because there very few of these men got videotape instruction. There was a war going on, and training centers were under great pressure to get men to Vietnam as quickly as possible, because the Marine and Army units were understaffed, underserved. They needed replacements as quickly as possible. So we'll never know whether the videotapes would have helped or not. I don't think they would have. Mm-hmm. But I think McNamara really believed that he could perform this miracle of taking these guys from the lower levels of society, many of them mentally limited, and turn them around.
Did they think about maybe some of the complications that would come with placing some of them within units that they might unfortunately be a liability? Do you think that they thought about that?
Boy, that's what so many of the people I interviewed and so many of the people who reviewed my book, like General Tony Zinni, a four-star general in the Marine Corps, retired now, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, he praised my book, and he said that the book should be read by every one of our political leaders who need to understand the effects of stupid decisions made by those who do not understand the nature of war. And I heard from so many veterans who said that, Andrew, you said liability. So many veterans that I interviewed said the exact same thing, that one said, if you get a low IQ man in your outfit, you go on a patrol, you have to spend most of your time worrying about whether he's going to shoot himself or a comrade, that he is a liability.
Mm-hmm. That's true. You know, Hamilton, one of the things that we were afraid of, you know, you lose being afraid after a while, you know, in a war, you lose it. But we would always catch some of these guys, they would light their cigarettes up at night.
Yeah.
You know, they would light up their cigarettes. Or they would get up, if we were dug in, you know, on a hillside or something, and we would be dug in, they would get up out of their hole and just walk, you know, over to another hole to talk to somebody, and not have a problem with that. Or they would, you know, just leave their rifle. They would leave their rifle on, and it's not their fault, you know, and we knew that wasn't their fault, but they had such a hard time, you know. They would talk. One thing you learn in the field, you talk in whispers. You don't, you don't holler. You know, you talk really, really low. Well, these guys didn't do that. You know, they talked loud.
Oh,
and it was a real problem. They, you know, some of us, you know, really felt sorry for these guys and tried to help them as much we can, but. You know, it wasn't their fault. They should never have been there in the first place. And your book, you know, really points that out. What percentage of these guys? Well, let me ask you: didn't Johnson and which Johnson drafted me? So I have a really dislike for that guy. But didn't he and McNamara try to push this thing as a jobs? As jobs that these guys would learn, and it would be a job for these guys.
Yeah, there would be work for them in the military, and they emphasized jobs later.
Right.
That they would be trained. They would be, McNamara used the term rehabilitated.
Wow.
And Lyndon Johnson in one of those secret tapes said, well, you know, we'll get these guys in and we'll teach them to bathe every day and shave every morning. And when we get through with them, they'll be able to drive a truck or stand as a night guard at a factory. You know, he's talking about how they're going to rehabilitate these men.
Right, right. Let me, and another question. I was just writing a note to Angie here. And what percentage of these McNamara's 100,000 were black and Hispanic?
Roughly 45% of the men were minority, which means,
wow.
As you say, African-American, Hispanic, American Indian, and so on.
Wow, that high.
And the other 55% were white, and they were primarily from the South, especially the Appalachian, the impoverished regions.
Jeez, that's just amazing. I didn't remember that was 45% were minorities.
I'm interested in, when I was reading some reviews about the book, I'm going to actually read it. I'm going to borrow it from Marvin after today. But it talks about some of the people being criminals. Is that right?
Yeah.
Can you expand on that?
One of the sections I have on the book is on, not only did Johnson and McNamara take in these low IQ men, but they also lowered standards for physical fitness, and they took in psychologically disabled people, and especially criminals. The military for years had a program where they would grant what they call moral waivers for felons and other criminals, and it was very common in the Vietnam War era for recruiters and judges to work out an arrangement. The criminal justice system would get a man who was he was always drunk and fighting, or he was breaking into houses, or he was getting into gang fights or whatever. And the judge would haul the young man in front of him and say, he would say, okay, you can go to prison, I'm going to send you to prison, or you can join the Army or the Marine Corps. Now, what is your choice? And in so many cases, the men, of course, chose the military. And I've got interviews of veterans who talk about these criminals. Some of them did okay. Some of them sort of straightened up. And that was the idea, that the military would, you know, make these men develop self-discipline and be respectable citizens. And some of them were okay. But there are other cases of the criminals engaging in thefts and drug abuse, serious drug abuse, even murder. A lot of these men ended up with fragging. You probably know about fragging, that the use of fragmentation grenades. In the middle of the night, an officer or a sergeant who was considered bad, or for some reason someone had a grudge against them, or they had rolled the grenade in. And it was almost a foolproof crime, because there were no fingerprints. Of course, the grenade exploded. And it was in the dark of night, so nobody saw the crime. So most of the men who committed fragging got away with it. And I have a quote from Colin Powell, you know, the General Powell, later Secretary of State and so on. He said that when he was in Vietnam, when he was a major, that he would, every night, he would move his bunk his cot, I should say. He would move his cot to a different place in the big tent that he slept in, so that if anybody had issues with authority, I think is the way he put it, they wouldn't know exactly where he was going to be sleeping.
Hmm.
And there were a lot of officers like Colin Powell who worried. I interviewed one who slept in the military intelligence bunker every night to avoid being fragged, as the term was. So these criminals, and the criminals caused so much mayhem in the last year or two of the war. They were the men who refused to go out on patrols. They became heroin users, some of them. And the Long Bend stockade was just filled with these men.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Now I don't want to, you know, indicate that all of the criminals were bad, but they caused an inordinate amount of breakdown of discipline and fragging.
Yeah, because at that time, towards the end of the war, I mean, the military was falling apart anyway, you know.
Yeah.
It was just disintegrating. And to have these guys in there, my friend, excuse me, my friend said that in his unit, when they would get one of these poor guys, that they would keep them for a certain amount of time, put them on details like, you know, burning waste or, you know, doing just nothing jobs around the company area if they could keep them from going to the field. Just doing just basic nothing things.
Yeah.
And they would transfer them. If these guys got in trouble, you know, with the MPs, or if they went downtown and got in trouble downtown, or got in fights, or whatever, that they would just transfer them to another units. So these guys were being, like, transferred here, transferred there, you know, all, you know, just to get rid of them.
Yeah.
Just to get rid of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was a real problem. Hamilton, these guys, you know, I felt so, that these guys, probably a lot of them wanted to do good.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them, they were nice guys. I mean, if you talk to these guys, you sit down and talk to them, it was just like talking to guys you knew in high school.
Yeah.
You know. And but they just couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. I was talking to Tammy this morning, our engineer, and we were talking about Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
You know how that movie Hamilton, that movie angered me.
Yeah.
I was very angry with that movie. You know,
yeah.
Because I knew guys like that, and to do what they did in that movie about these guys was just, to me, was horrible.
Yeah.
Was horrible. So I remember, I'm sorry I'm going off here, but I remember these guys getting letters from home, Hamilton, and couldn't read them.
Yeah.
You know, they would come to us guys, you know, and
yeah.
We would read their letters for them. And to look at the writing that their families couldn't write very well.
Yeah.
You know, they hardly could spell. They couldn't put a sentence together. They were poor. They would talk about, you know, are you going to send more money home this month? You know, or whatever like that. And they came from poor families, most of them.
Yeah.
And you know, we would do that and we would write letters for them. You know, they say, can you write my mom a letter, could you write, you know, my daddy a letter? And we would write letters for them. And I mean, these guys would want to know, you know, did my sister have her baby, you know, is my brother out of jail, you know, and things like that, you know. That and one of the, I would say 99% of these guys, the first thing they wanted us to write was, tell my mommy I'm okay.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that's the kind of guys that these guys were. And, you know, bless their hearts. Bless their hearts. You know, they tried. They tried. Yeah. So, you know, after they were out of the service, what percentage got dishonorables?
I don't have that. I was unable to get that. But from the veterans counselors I've talked to, it was a large number.
Mm.
Why is that?
Well, technology
didn't save them.
I'm sorry.
I said that the technology rehabilitation didn't save work. Them.
Yeah, that's correct. It's ironic that these men were unsuitable for military service.
Boy, no kidding.
And one of the major reasons for the dishonorable discharges were unsuitability. Well, of course they were unsuitable. That's, you know, they were unsuitable when they were taken in and they didn't fit. They were unsuitable. And then they were discharged for, that was the main thing, unsuitability.
Mm-hmm.
But they were also discharged for things like bedwetting.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
And psychological disorders, mm-hmm. which is a term they would use for so-called misfits, men who just, you know, again, mm-hmm. didn't fit in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, one thing that I'm often asked is, okay, McNamara and Johnson took these men in. Why didn't they give them jobs in the rear, jobs away from danger, or jobs back in the States? If you had to draft them, why did you have to send them to combat?
Send them to Europe.
Yeah, right. We've already talked about how some sergeants and officers protected these men,
mm-hmm.
and they're heroes in my book, those men.
Yep.
But one of the most illuminating interviews I had for my book was an interview with Lieutenant Colonel Leslie John Shellhase, who had been in World War II. He had been wounded in the Battle of the Bulge, and he was a lieutenant colonel under McNamara in the Office of Personnel Management, or whatever its technical term is.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a central author of Project 100,000.
Wow.
And he was enraged. He was sick. He was sickened to see that so many of these men ended up being sent into combat and so many of them ended up being killed. He said, we never intended for these men to be anywhere near combat. They were supposed to work in rear areas doing menial jobs, you know, peeling potatoes and sweeping mm-hmm. floors and so on. And somewhere along the line, probably through McNamara's grandiose ideas about lifting these men out of ignorance, somewhere along the line, these men did not get jobs like peeling potatoes and sweeping floors. and Shell Hayes, who gave me a lot of information for the book, he was upset. He said, I was one of the creators of Project 100,000.
That must just devastated him.
It did. He was just tormented by that.
I wonder how many of these guys were POWs.
I tell about one Project 100,000 man who was a prisoner of war of the Viet Cong,
mm-hmm.
and he went crazy, and he. Let me see if I can tell things that you can say on.
Yeah, be careful.
He would scream at the guards mm-hmm. all day long, and they would take him and outside in the hot sun and tie him up in a tree or put him on an ant heap,
mm.
and he would scream and scream. He soiled himself constantly, and the other men had to clean him up.
Mm-hmm.
And the POW who told about it said, this really angered me more than anything, is why was this, of course the term in those days was mentally retarded, we mm-hmm. don't use that term mm-hmm. now, but But he said, why was this mentally retarded man drafted into the Army?
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I'm going to ask my buddy. I have a buddy, Bob Chenoweth, who was a POW for 5.5 years, who he was a prisoner down in the South in the jungle camps for, I think, 2.5 of those 5.5 years. I'm going to ask him about if he knows any of them, of those poor guys that got that. Because I would imagine that, yeah, they would probably be a candidate to be captured, you know, just
yeah.
walking off or doing doing something like that, Hamilton.
Yeah.
And it's just a sad state of the affairs. And I wonder what the suicide rate is for those guys.
Well, the counselors I've talked to say that these guys are unable to get jobs,
yep.
unable to get veterans benefits because of their dishonorable discharges,
yep.
so many of them. And so I imagine the suicide rate is high, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't have any statistics on it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's probably pretty high. Hamilton, I want to really thank you for coming back on and talking about this. I think it's really really important that the American people know what their government did to the poor guys that, you know, that should never have been in the military and shouldn't have been in the war.
Yeah.
And the way they were treated and the way that probably to this day that these poor guys are suffering for what happened to them.
Oh, if I could quickly mention,
go ahead.
I have a YouTube video,
ooh.
Free video that gives more details. It all you do is go to youtube.com and type in McNamara's Folly.
Okay, gotcha.
And there's that video.
We'll go ahead and post that on our Facebook
yeah.
page too.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we'll put it on the Facebook too. Again, I want to really thank you for coming back on and talking and about this because it's near and dear to my heart and it's a very good book and thanks a lot, Hamilton.
Well, thank you.
My thanks to you, Marvin, and to you, Angie. I appreciate your
thank you so much
having me.
Okay, thanks, buddy.
Okay,
great. We were talking to Hamilton Gregory. He's the author of McNamara's Folly, the use of low IQ troops in the Vietnam War. And like I said, it's one of the books that I go back and I read again and again and again. And the other ones are Waiting for an Army to Die by Fred Wilcox, Working Class War by Christian Appy, and now McNamara's Folly. So if you're interested in the, you know, what happened in the war in Vietnam, these books would be really good books for you to read, even if you're not a veteran. They're really good. Like Angie's going to take my book and she's going to read it. I want to talk just a little bit before we don't have very much time, but I want to talk about the show that Ani did and Lynn did, and that was a really good, really wonderful show. And I've been thinking about that all week, you know, about strong women and the women, strong women I've had in my life. And I thought that show, I'm really glad. I don't know if we, thinking about it, you know, helped or whatever. I've lost two really strong, important women in my life, my wife and my mother. And I thought that this was a very, very good show. And I'm really glad they did it. You know, I'm really lucky. Even though my mom and my wife are gone, I got really strong, strong women around me, like Angie. You know, she's strong. And Tammy, you know, they're strong. And we have Ani and Lynn. And we have Teresa Mitchell. You know, strong, strong women. And we have we had Kathleen Stevenson for years at this station. You know, KBOO has strong women. you know, here taking, you know, taking on these social issues that are so really important, and being leaders and strong and you know, tell the truth. And I really appreciate that, and I'm glad they're in my life. But also, I'm really glad, happy for you guys, the listeners, too. You know, you've let me be on this show for 26 years. 26 years you let me be on this
let
show.
Let him.
Yeah.
You let him.
You let me be on this show for 26 years. And KBOO has a really important part, you know, for the community, and not just for Oregon, but around the world. It's an important radio station. And if you're not a member, you know, I kind of really wish you would become a member. And if you want to learn how to, you know, how a radio station, come down. You can learn. You know, you can learn how to do radio. And you can meet these wonderful people we have here. And it'll change your life. It'll literally change your life by meeting some of these people that work down here. And it's, you know, we've done shows on women in the military, and we've had nurses, we've had people in women in Army, Navy, Marines, Angie in the Army. I mean, in Marines.
I was in the Navy, actually.
I mean, the Navy.
Eventually, you'll get one of the branches right.
She was in the Army, Navy, or the Marines. She was in one of those.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure. Cause
there's four of them.
We've talked about it.
You've only got four options.
We've talked about it.
Name three of them.
And I would like for someday us to do a show on women in the military, especially
we did.
I know, but I want to do one on basically the mental health, you know, that you go, you know, the mental health part of it, where women have it's supposed to, at the VA, if they're still doing it, don't they have a special section for women medical?
Yeah, they do. That's for primary care.
Right, that's what I want to talk about.
You want to talk about primary care for women,
right,
veterans?
Right. Because
okay.
I think that's a problem.
Well, it's better addressed in Portland than it is throughout the rest of the United States, that's for sure. Because, I mean, there's not a lot of facilities in other parts of the U.S. that even know how to address they might not even have an OBGYN doctor.
See, that's another problem.
And not only that, but...
How about pregnancy?
Well, there's that and military sexual trauma.
Right.
It's just, they have no idea how to even address that stuff.
Right. What if a veteran, she becomes pregnant? Can she go to the VA and have her baby?
If she is enrolled in the veterans, if she's enrolled there, yes. But if she's not, then no. If you have to have a service-connected disability. When you get out of the military, you get your first 5 years free,
mm-hmm,
for health care. And then if you don't have a service-connected disability or were retired,
mm-hmm,
within the military, then you're kicked off.
Wow, that's just horrible.
That's what happens.
Five years,
yes.
See, that's a problem too. That's a real problem. That's like that, and especially, boy, the military sexual trauma is just, that's so devastating, just so devastating. And well, we're out of time. We've got a couple minutes here, and I want to thank Hamilton for being on the show. I want to thank all of you folks for listening to us. I want to thank Angie, and she's going to read this book. I want to thank Tammy for being on with us for the last 15 years or so. And we'll be back Friday, August 18th at 9 a.m., and there it is.
At the end of the early British wars, The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. Always the young to fall.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Life, Art, Being, Integrative Arts Festival, taking place July 28th to August 5th at various locations around Portland. The Life, Art, Being Integrative Arts Festival will include workshops, panel discussions, and performances about somatic, expressive, deep ecology, and community building, creative, and ecological practices. Again, that's the Life, Art, Being Integrative Arts Festival taking place July 28th to August 5th at various locations around Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Willamette River Festival and Movie in the Park, Sunday, July 30th from 1 to 10 p.m. at the Cathedral Park waterfront in Portland. The Willamette River Festival is a celebration on the waterfront with live music by Shanghai on the Willamette, Norman Sylvester, and more, as well as a beer garden, food carts, an environmental fair, DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid, and more. Again, that's the Willamette River Festival and